Columbia, I've seen your mountains high, seen your pretty rainbows and your blue crystal skies, watched your winding rivers as they flow around the bend. To me, you're not a stranger, you'll always be a friend.
Coming to you from the West Coast, this is Politicos, the BC Politics Podcast. This is episode 93. If you haven't already, make sure to subscribe and leave a review wherever you found us. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter, where we're at Politicos Pod, and support the show at patreon.com/politicos.
I'm Scott Blindboom.
And I'm Ian Bushfield.
Quick programming note, this week and next week, we're playing pre-recorded interviews as I'm on holidays this week. We'll be back to you in mid-July. On this episode, we're going to be diving into student housing with Patrick Meehan. First, though, we have to thank our premier sponsors, Lindsay Tedds and Blake Hodson, for helping make the show possible. Politicoast is in partnership with BC Today, British Columbia's daily newsletter dedicated exclusively to BC politics. Sign up for a free trial to have unique coverage of the BC legislature delivered to your inbox every morning. Listeners to Politicoast, enter the offer code CITIZEN for access to a special rate for your free two-week trial of the newsletter. Go to britishcolumbiatoday.ca. Patrick Meehan, fellow co-host of Canby Report, one of the co-hosts of Podkeep Our Land. You have a day job, it turns out.
I do have a day job, in fact. In my last job, I was the policy researcher for the Kwantlen Association, and today I'm the policy researcher for the Capilano Student Union. And what that entails is generally looking at what different levels of government as well as university policies affect students and ways to improve that.
And one of the things that came out of this was there's this Alliance of BC Students, which I take it is the group that represents all of these different student associations.
Yeah, without getting into the internecine student politics of it all, because those get weird. There's six student unions now that are members of the Alliance of BC Students. Mostly they're purpose-built, special-purpose teaching universities, as they're called. And so they're sort of the Capilanos, Kwantlens, and whatnot of the world.
And you came up with this report, Where's the Housing? Student Housing for Everyone.
Yeah, we released it in 2016. We'd been advocating for on-campus student housing for a number of years. Basically, a government policy precluded universities and colleges from building housing in a way that was weird but made sense when you got into the details of it. And so nobody had really built any student housing in about 10 years at the point that we were really pushing for this. And the idea was that if you build that, it'll improve students' lives and improve universities. And that was how we'd branded it for a couple of years, which I think is accurate. But then in 2016, we decided to flip it on its head a bit and say, why don't we talk about the impact on the rental market that this will have?
And what is the impact on the rental market?
Immense would be the best way to put it. I think, Scott, you probably know the data better than I do in some ways. But Vancouver, I think, is building purpose-built rental at the fastest clip it's built it in decades. And it's something like 1,700 units a year.
Approximately, yeah. Yeah, and that's then undershooting the targets where they're aiming for around 2,000.
Yeah, and region-wide, we're seeing less than 3,000 rental units being built a year. And that's keeping this rental market really crippled. What you could do if you allow universities to build student housing, and all that is a debt allocation. It's not even needing significant direct funding from the government. If you allow universities to take on debt to build student housing, what we'd be looking at is what my business estimate was it would build about 13,000 student housing spaces over 10 years, or 1,300 units a year, which is, you know, a third of what gets built, like a 30% increase over what gets built now.
And that would assumedly take those rentals, like students right now have to rent somewhere. And if students are then renting at UBC, at UVic, at Kwantlen, wherever, then in theory, more spaces get opened up across the city for people who aren't students. And so there's this knock-on effect.
Yeah, that was exactly how it was rebranded. And that's exactly how the fight was. And if you're building that much housing, you really are starting to pull people out of the market. But also, I mean, when you think about the kind of places that students live in, they're not living in typically expensive rentals. So they're living in the low end of the rental stock that's available. So what you're doing is you're actually freeing up that low end stock for people that are in more precarious work or perhaps have other barriers that are preventing them from getting this housing. Because generally people want to rent out their basement suites or what have you to students because they know they've got a student loan, potentially parental support, and so on and so forth. Whereas somebody without those supports is going to be less likely to get a landlord that wants to take them on.
So why aren't we building this housing?
we had a meeting with Carol Taylor about it, actually, and she put it really well. In 2007, the BC government switched over to generally accepted accounting principles, or GAAP accounting, which is a form of accounting that no other province uses. And what it's meant to do is it's meant to prevent the government from sort of hiding debt in subsidiary public bodies. Essentially, BC Hydro's debt is government debt in terms of its accounting reporting to Moody's and Standard & Poor's. What that means is if a university like SFU, for example, were to build a $40 million, 600-unit student housing build, that would count as government debt. And government is very tight on how it controls government debt and how much it allows per year. And so they basically said, essentially said, nobody's allowed to build student housing. UBC managed to sort of carry on at a bit of a clip because they sort of loan money to themselves because their endowment is so large, they're able to sort of funnel it around, but nobody else has that capacity.
So the cost to the government you pitch here is $18 million and you want this $1.8 billion. So what's the actual, where's that $18 million coming from? What is it going to?
The argument for that was that it would be startup cash to sort of infuse the process and get it moving and then ensure and then open up the reserves for debt allocation, which we didn't include in that number figure there. The BC government in the budget this year did basically take this on. They're doing some direct funding, not a whole lot, but they're allowing over 3 years, $450 million in debt allocation for universities to take on to build student housing. And we figure that it's sort of based on my estimates and how much housing costs to build for student housing, which is fairly low actually per bed, could be building approximately over that, like over a, say a 10-year window of, as you, it all gets built out but funded in the first 3 years. We could be looking at that building, say, the government is saying is 7 to 8,000 units of housing. It could be even more depending on construction costs.
So speaking of construction costs, I took a look at the report you put it together for this, and one thing that jumped out at me is the costs are fairly low per bed.
Yeah, it's really surprising.
Yeah. Is that taken into account the rising construction costs where hard costs are over $200 a square foot now and land costs are even more?
That's a good question. Well, land costs don't matter. The whole point of this is that the universities all have the land sitting around doing nothing right now. Some of it's parking lots, some of it's grass fields. And so there's no land acquisition costs, which is what makes this so inexpensive. But what we did with the estimate there, what I did with the estimate was we took a look at all of UBC's builds over the last 10 years for residences and averaged it out. Now, obviously, Vancouver's builds are more expensive than the Okanagan builds because UBC Okanagan is not in Vancouver's housing market and it's cheaper to build things. But the numbers also ended up getting a little artificially inflated because the giant wooden tower building, I think the
Brock Commons?
The tallest wood structured building in Western Canada or whatever it is. That was a mandate essentially from the province to build. And so it costs significantly more per unit to build because concrete's cheaper, I guess.
I imagine when you're building the first tall giant wood skyscraper.
It's funny because the actual technical term for it, like for the building, the actual building's name was something like large wood structure.
Well, let's rewind a bit. And one of the things you lay out in this report is how BC has fallen behind. And you look specifically at Alberta, and maybe you can just sort of walk us through where this student housing gap almost is and why Alberta as an example.
This is the funniest thing was I was randomly flying from Ottawa to Vancouver one day, a couple of years ago, maybe 4 years ago, and I ended up sitting next to a government appointee to Mount Royal University's Board of Governors. She saw that I was working on some university stuff and asked what university I was affiliated with, and we got chatting about it. To rewind a little bit, BC institutions can take on debt to build housing all they want if they can get the signature of the Minister of Finance and the Minister of Advanced Education. It's Section 61, I think it is, of the University Act, says that you just need the signatures of both, but the BC government said they wouldn't do it. Alberta has this exact same component, essentially, but the Alberta government has been just saying yes over and over again. And so we use that as a benchmark because those institutions are fairly analogous to ours. And what we found was that generally their universities, the Big Two and Lethbridge, were housing about 25% of their students in residence. And the regional teaching institutions, the institutions that aren't as heavy on four-year programs, they're housing about 10%. And so we just assumed that the same level would apply to BC. I think that's a really conservative estimate because, housing is not the same problem it is in Alberta. And similarly, the Alberta institutions are in much better geographical areas.
Yeah, Edmonton's cities. Right near downtown.
Yeah. Alberta. U of A is literally like next to downtown. U of C is just outside of downtown.
They haven't put them at far end of peninsulas or on top of mountains. Or
yeah. They're both on light rail transit.
They're both on rail lines. Yeah, Mount Royal and McEwen are both like fairly close to downtown as well. And so we figured with them being closer to better housing options, them having a cheaper housing market, that they would have a lower demand than BC does. And that seems to be borne out with Thompson Rivers now building 500 more units, which puts it well above what we put as the minimum number that we estimated for them.
The government announced in their throne speech that they were going to do a bunch of this fund. Can you walk us through what their commitments are?
Yeah, it was really cool to see because, you know, it's sort of not every day that you work on a project that the government takes on and does. You know, we did what any lobbyist organization does is in the lead up to the election. We met with both Liberals and the NDP and the Greens, and we talked to them extensively about housing and student housing. And we said, this is a thing you could put in your platform. And the BC NDP chose to take it on, put it in their platform, which we were happy with. And then we sort of had to hope that it would translate into government, because not all platform things do. But in the budget, they announced that over 3 years, they would be allocating for universities still to build up to $450 million for student housing. Which, you know, is a lot of money, and that's over a short window of time. $450 million over 3 years means, you know, get shovels in the ground fast. And I know I've heard that a lot of institutions are ready to go, and just Thompson Rivers happens to be the first one out of the gate last week.
So it came out with the budget, the money. Thompson Rivers has made its announcement. Do you expect more?
How soon? I expect a lot more. I know a lot of institutions are moving fast on this. My understanding is, I don't know this from any inside perspective, but from what I've been hearing is Douglas and Quantlin are both moving forward on proposals that they've been mulling over for quite some time. Basically, everybody wants this. It's going to be, I think, a race to get to use the money rather than pushing universities to do it.
If they don't spend the $400+ million, do they still, in the next 3 years, is it still going to be available to them? Or because it takes a while to get a construction project.
Well, I mean, all you need is the money allocation, and then it just comes out of that year's fiscal. And so, you know, the famous phrase in government is it takes 3 years to build a building. And, you know, we've got 3 years, and they'll have to pay it back. It's $450 million in loan to the institutions, essentially. But they'll pay it back at government interest rates, which is something like 1% below prime. So the interest rate is quite appealing for them.
Well, and that raises a question or a concern that maybe student bodies could have, as in the students who are very comfortable, I guess, and not looking for places to live, that if their university is taking on a bunch of additional debt, does that not risk them having extra debt financing and extra expenses, and therefore that'll be put back on the backs of students through increased tuition?
No, the universities are going to keep that really covered off so that the residences will pay for themselves through residence fees. They'll be very careful about that. And I think that we'll see, and I think we will see, because of the low financing costs, we will see probably fairly affordable housing costs. It's going to be interesting to see, but we're going to definitely see well below market.
The TRU, you mentioned the numbers a couple of times, and you said that was sort of at one end of the range of what you'd predicted. But I think we were talking earlier about how that scale that they're doing at Thompson Rivers could mean your report was very conservative.
Oh, yeah. I was fairly certain that my report was conservative, but we wanted to make sure we came up with numbers that were reasonable. UBC wants to house 40% of their full-time students in residence. That's a lot of students. They have, you know, 45,000 students.
So you also mentioned in the report that this connects into our transit system and that most of the really busy bus lines in the region all point to universities. Will this also help congestion?
Yeah, I think, I mean, you look at it, let's use Capilano as an example, where they have 7,000 students. They're getting there somehow. 65% of them live south of the North Shore. So they're coming over the Second Narrows Bridge, and they're either doing it by car or by bus. I mean, I cycle to work, but, you know,
you're not passing a whack of students on the way.
It's not exactly a huge percentage of the student body. But if you pull, you know, 1,000 students onto campus, maybe that's 100 cars a day less over the Second Narrows Bridge. And maybe that's 200 people less on the buses going over the Second Narrows Bridge. Just look at everything that services UBC or all of the bus infrastructure that's required for SFU. And maybe some of that can be reduced, those direct routes between, you know, Production Way and SFU, and shunted to other parts of the region, because you move another 3,000 students into SFU.
I'm hearing that student housing is a lot cheaper than another SkyTrain line.
Well, but, there's always the gondola at SFU. It seems to be back on the table.
Yeah, that is in the 10-year plan.
Oh, that's good.
It'd
be definitely cheaper than a SkyTrain to SFU.
I think if the phrase is elections matter and who runs the mayor's council matters, it just so happens that gondola is in Burnaby.
But the point, the idea that, you know, student, like one of the sustainable infrastructure ideas is to have people live near where they work or go to school. And the idea of having, you know, 40% of your students right next to their classrooms just seems to make sense. Like, it's how I think universities used to be. And then we kind of moved to this distributed live across the city model.
I spent all 4 years of my degree living on campus. And part of the reason why is I didn't want to have to do the commute in the Kingston winter without a car. Like, it was... It would have sucked.
Yeah, absolutely. I think this meets so many of our societal goals and governmental goals as well. You know, greenhouse gas emission goals, etc. It's to just move them on campus. Get them out of the way.
Has there been any pushback from any of the universities or of any, like, say, the teaching colleges not been super keen on in this? Or are you seeing even the smaller schools?
Yeah, I don't think there's a single institution that doesn't want to build housing. Every institution is feeling a crunch for students because they can't afford to go to school. And housing is one of those costs that the universities can't control for, and now they might be able to.
So the government's on board, the universities are on board. Has anyone pushed back at all on this?
Nope. That's the fascinating thing, is that this was, I think, and I don't want to put a partisan lens to it, but I think the last government for the 4 years that it was, for the last term at least, didn't have much of an interest in doing things. And I think this is one of those policies that was an inadvertent casualty of the change in accounting principles. Nobody wanted to shut down the ability to build student housing when they switched to gap accounting. It just was an innocent thing that it was an outcome of that decision. And then it was never fixed. And now it is.
I mean, this is unrelated a bit to the student housing, but is the government sticking with gap accounting, even though we have a new...
Yep. I don't think you'll ever see a government move away from something called generally accepted accounting principles.
Even if they're the only government that actually uses generally
accepted. Yeah, even if they're not generally accepted.
Although I found with accountants, they have like 3 or 4 professional designations, I think, because they just like...
No, they're down to one. They merged them all down to CMA now from CPA and CA. Yeah, okay. And now it's CMA. My sister's an accountant. That's the only way, right. Reason I knew that.
I was just trying to think for a second, like they might find the like... really accepted principle or the like best principle or
practices accounting. You know, I think gap accounting is hard for the provincial government to manage because it means they can't hide debt places, but it's also not bad that they can't hide debt places. You know, we saw that in 72 when the Dave Barrett government took over, was they discovered that the Bennett government had been hiding debt all over the place and the government was actually really debt riddled. And you saw the exact same thing. You see the exact same thing every decade or so. A new report comes out saying that, you know, so and such and such body of the government is nearly insolvent because, you know, ICBC, the classic example where, you know, they're financially insolvent because the government has been, you know, taking money from them.
So one of the issues in the local housing market here is that there just isn't a huge amount of spare construction capacity.
That's a good question, yeah.
Is that a concern for building out these residents in the Lower Mainland?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, that could very easily slow down the process or, like you said earlier, make it more expensive. We could see that for sure. But, I mean, building is happening. And you don't need as many permitting requirements for student housing on campus. You don't need the same zoning expansions. You still have to go hand in hand to the municipalities to ask to get exempted from things like parking minimums and stuff like that. But
although in UBC's case, they set their own rules.
Although, yeah, UBC doesn't really have to worry about that. But most municipalities, if you say, can we waive some of the parking minimum requirements in order to build some student housing? They're going to go, well, sure.
Yeah, a whole bunch of students living in dorms don't tend to bring their cars.
And
yeah.
I noticed in this one, you very carefully selected all the parking spots in the little maps at the back.
Yeah, well, maybe talk about those maps, because those are kind of interesting visualization of how much...
Yeah, at the back of the report, we put in some just Google Maps images of different campuses across BC, particularly some of the suburban ones. And there is a huge portion of university-owned land dedicated for parking.
And like surface lots, not just
surface
structures.
Lots. Yep, just surface lots. And, you know, if you build a student residence on some of that and you cannibalize some of the parking, you just put it underground if you want. And
does that cost?
Yeah, it adds a cost for sure. But if you do that, you're going to remove some of the people driving to school anyways. Why not? And people really latched on and loved those maps, actually. Like when we went to meetings with government officials and stuff like that, different electeds just really loved those maps because I think it really put it into perspective. And then you can do it at home too. You can just go to, you know, Google Maps and look up any university campus. You can see an outline of what the campus property lines are, and it's pretty easy to see that they've got a lot of unused land. Like Langara particularly is a fascinating test case of this because of just how big that land is and just what percentage of their student body comes by transit.
I mean, land is the big fight and struggle here in Vancouver for so many sides, and whether we rezone this or nobody gets really, like some people get upset about taking a parking lot away, but even if you say, all right, we're going to take away 100 surface spaces, we'll build you a parkade with 80.
Yep.
And then we'll put 400 people living there.
Yeah. Well, and it's funny too, like land is, the land acquisition is the easy part for the universities because they already have it. But also Vancouver has a bunch of land that they want to set aside for housing, right? We talked on Cambie Report, we talked to Stephanie Allen, who's her company that builds nonprofit housing is doing a construction project at the empty parking lot the city owns at 6th and Main. But you still have to pay the money to build it. And so there's those two elements. So Vancouver can put up all the land at once. It doesn't have the financial capacity to build on it. But the universities now do because the province just has to allow them to earmark a debt allocation. And they don't even have to go to Van City. They just go to the financial coffers of the provincial government and do it. And this is so much easier than what Vancouver is trying to stitch together, and such an easy win.
It's such a simple, easy win. Like you're saying that, you know, there's only so much we can say.
we did get to do one really cool thing was when we launched the campaign, the culmination of the campaign was we got a bunch of cardboard boxes, cardboard moving boxes that were, you know, about 3 feet, 4 feet, 5 feet high. And we painted them to look like condos. And we brought them all to the legislature grounds and put them out on the legislature grounds. That was really fun to do. Had all these like student housing cardboard boxes that were houses all stitched all across the legislature lawn.
Well, did you get any feedback from the other parties? I'm assuming, like you said, the NDP was on board for this. I imagine the Greens didn't have any issue.
The Greens were too. And, you know, I think a lot of elements within the Liberal Party were too. We definitely had, Andrew Wilkinson as Minister of Defense Education definitely agreed with the idea in principle. But I think they were having a lot of difficulties getting any funding out of Treasury at that point. And, you know, for whatever reason, the BC Liberals were reticent to allow any debt allocation because of they wanted to maintain the credit rating. I don't think anyone is going to oppose the BC government doing this now. And so I think that's the nice thing, that the political will is there now.
Is there anything else in the report or that you'd like to touch on?
Not so much. I think it's fascinating to me that this is such an easy policy to result in, you know, potentially 2,000 more rental units per year added to the Lower Mainland market. Like we estimated at 1,300, but I think you could easily go up to 2,000 a year added to the market for five solid years. And like, that would be a huge impact to affordability in the region.
So is that basically what you're just hoping to keep hearing from the government, is that yes, we'll do this, we'll go at double what you said and stick with that for 3 years? And
I mean, they've got a mandate to build 110,000 housing units as part of their election pledge, and this is going to help them do it in a big way. They just knocked 500 off that list at Thompson Rivers, so this is gonna really help.
Well, I guess there'll be thousands more student housing, and in the very near future lots of students will be living on campus. I guess one thing that does raise, and you mentioned this in the report, is a lot of students who live on campus tend to be international. And
yeah,
that had element, how does that work?
Yeah, the BC government about 10 years ago removed all of the barrier, all the limitations to internationalization of education. And so when I was an undergrad back about 13 years ago, 11% of UBC students were international students because the maximum was 11%. The government said, no more than 11% of your students can be international students. Then the next year it was 12, and the next year was 14. And then eventually they just said, there's no limit, go. And part of the reason was, I think it was a very effective way for them to increase funding for universities without increasing funding for universities. Mm-hmm. It doesn't cost the government anything, and it allows the universities to bring in a bunch of international students that help subsidize the universities. We've turned it into a bit of a business. Like, you know how Nova Scotia was always famous for turning education into a money-making industry? Mm-hmm. Well, we've sort of turned around and realized that's a pretty good model for good and bad. There's, you know, a lot of arguments on both sides of it. And so what we've seen over the last 10 years is a massive expansion in the number of international students. And they're living somewhere. And so they're putting, again, another weight on the housing market. Now, I want to be careful here because it's easy to get sort of...
nativist.
Anytime you use the phrase international, anything to do with the housing market, sometimes it can look bad. Mm-hmm. I'm certainly not saying that it's good or bad that they're here, but they're here. And so housing them on campus is going to help them be closer to community, stitch them into their university community, and also keep them from sort of creating a further strain on an already strained housing market.
Well, one thing... like, even I lived in res at University of Alberta for 2 years, and we didn't have a massive international student population there, but there would be 4 or 5 international students per floor, you know, out of 25 rooms or whatever. So it's a way to meet people from around the world, build that multicultural ideal of Canada, perhaps.
Well, and residence has its own huge value add to students, like you said. You know, I always use the example that Justin Trudeau and Gerald Butts were across the hall from each other at university residence, and that's how they got to know each other, and that created a lifelong bond that resulted in, you know, a prime minister and his, you know, right-hand person.
And depending on your political ideology, that could be really good or really bad.
Yeah. But, you know, it's that the connections you make in residence are your sort of lifelong connections. If you're, you know, that's where businesses can be sprung out of, right? You think about, to use the worst example, I'm pretty sure Mark Zuckerberg was living in residence at Harvard when he came up.
I mean, that's
with
what I learned from Social Network.
Yeah, Facebook. And so, it's that's really where you get a lot of these things. And so, that residence is going to mean better education because you're going to be closer to your school. You're going to be able to go back and forth and a better community.
I don't have anything else, Steve. Right. Well, Patrick, why not you tell the listeners where they can find you and your organization?
Oh, this is weird feeling. I'm not used to being the guest on a podcast. You can find me at Pat Meister on Twitter. And you can also find me at The Canby Report, where we record weekly with Ian. And if you're interested in looking into more of this, feel free to reach out to me. You can shoot me a message on Twitter.
And the Alliance of BC Students?
Yeah, Alliance of BC Students are bcstudents.ca. And you can find, I believe we've got my white paper up there as well. And if you Google around a bit for it, you can definitely find it. I like to think it's a pretty good report. And, you know, obviously it's hard for me to say that given that I wrote it. But it's I think, one of the coolest things I've gotten to do in my work.
And the other podcast that's now off hiatus?
Yeah, we're back off hiatus with Podkeep Our Land, which is if I could ever say it right.
It is luckily, the worst thing to actually record into a mic because of the plosives.
Yeah, luckily I don't have to say it very often because somebody else does. But we're a podcast about politics, people, politicians, and
parliaments.
Yeah. I'm not good at these alliterations. But we're back off hiatus. I think it was a really good episode. We got talking about salmon, as well as obviously the fact that BC has turned into a money laundering capital of the world. We got into that a little bit. Go BC. We're number one in something. And a couple of other issues. It's a pretty good episode, I think.
All right. Thanks for joining us.
Cheers.
And that has been Politicos. Find links to stories we mentioned in the show notes at politicos.ca. Leave us a review and let us know what you think. Support the show and get early access to our interviews at patreon.com/politicos. And if you have ideas for the show, feel free to send them to us. Thanks for listening.